Welcome, and thank you so much for joining us. I'm Sandra Ladd, and I'm the senior minister for First Christian Church Stillwater. We are growing a Christ-centered, compassionate church where all can connect to God's love. And we hope that in this time you experience growth. We pray that this time will help you focus and center on Christ, and that in this time you will sense care and compassion. We pray that this time provide you with a deeper connection to the love of God. Grace and peace be with you. And again, we thank you so much for gifting us with your time.
Have you seen those decorative signs like they sell at Hobby Lobby that say, in this house we, or let's see, in this family we. And then there's a list of rules like tell the truth, say I'm sorry, all of those. Or maybe you had the experience growing up that you knew what it meant to be a member of your family. Like, I'm a Turner, and I know what that means. It means we're probably musical, we're silly, we make jokes when we should be serious, but it also meant that we knew that we had to be a church. We knew we had to get along with each other. We knew that we had to help whenever there was opportunity. And you may have a similar list, good and bad, what that meant for you being a member of your family. And maybe even sometimes your mom said, that is not what our people do. I say a yes, yeah. It's important to know who you are, because our sense of self determines our actions, and that's what we're going to see this morning. Please stand with me for the reading of God's word as we read from Romans 8. Please join with me. So then, brothers and sisters, we are debtors, not to the flesh, to live according to the flesh. For if you live according to the flesh, you will die. But if by the Spirit you put to death the deeds of the body, you will live. For all who are led by the Spirit of God are children of God. For you did not receive a spirit of slavery to fall back into fear, but you have received a spirit of adoption. When we cry, Abba, Father, it is that our spirit bearing witness with our spirit that we are children of God. And if children, then heirs, heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ. If, in fact, we suffer with him so that we may also be glorified with him. I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory about to be revealed to us. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the children of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not of its own will, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to decay and will obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning in labor pains until now. Not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly while we wait for adoption, the redemption of our bodies. For in hope we were saved. Now hope that is seen is not hope, for who hopes for what is seen? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. Please be seated. I was not supposed to be up here today. That was not the original plan. In fact, I think some of you came expecting that you were going to see my husband, Russell, filling in for Sandra. He has taken a job, and he is working today. It's his first Sunday having to work, and so things have been kind of up in the air, so here I am. You know, and when you fill in last minute, you don't always get the same choice that maybe you would have if someone had said, oh, here's a list of Sundays to choose from, and here are great passages. I mean, that's a tricky kind of passage, and I haven't always been a fan of Romans, and I haven't always been a fan of Paul. I mean, let's be real. But I've changed, I've grown, I've learned. And there's a New Testament theologian, Scott McKnight, and he says that maybe the key to understanding the book of Romans is to start with the end. And he actually has a book called Reading Romans Backwards, where he encourages us to do that. You know, the church in Rome, and really it was a network of house churches, small churches, it was a really diverse place. I mean, first of all, we have a capital city, right? And then they had this really weird dynamic. The church had started out, it was a mix of Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians. It hadn't been Jewish. And then all the Jews got kicked out of Rome. And so then the church was just these Gentile Christians for several years. And then the Jewish Christians got to come back. Well, now we have a power struggle, because whose way is it going to be? So in the book of Romans, Paul is really trying to deal with this struggle of unity, which is most of his writing, all of his letters to the churches. But so if we consider that unity is his goal, then we go back and read from the beginning of Romans, and it's not supposed to be a book about personal justification or how one person comes to Christ. It is Paul saying, hey, everybody, you all are called. You all have sinned. Like, this is about all of us. This is a work calling us together. So he's trying to emphasize their common identity, which is what we see here in this particular text. That he is reminding them that they are all children of God, that they have all been called as heirs. And this adoption language, it always jumps out at me. My father was adopted, and I've always lived with that, and especially in the past few years as he found his birth family, but it's really been something interesting. But it would have been really important for the Jewish Christians, because they had been through a lot. I mean, they had been there and then kicked out and then back. I mean, just instability. They needed this strong language of adoption. And then for the Gentile Christians, for whom coming to Christ meant leaving everything they'd ever known, leaving their way of life. So everyone needed the security of a solid new identity. And these reminders of identity are one of the ways that God has always ministered to his people. So as I looked this week at our texts in the Revised Common Lectionary beyond this one, we have a passage from Isaiah 44 where God's messenger Isaiah has just spent all this time telling the king about how bad things are going to get, that they're going to lose everything to the Babylonians, that some people are going to be enslaved, they're going to be in exile, they're going to be surrounded by idolatry, and that it's bleak. And then God, through Isaiah, says, but here, Jacob, my servant, Israel, whom I've chosen, I am the first and I am the last. Beside me, there is no God. God is saying, whatever happens, I'm yours, you're mine. And then we look at Genesis 28, which is the continuation of the story we read last week. And actually, there's a bit that happened in between that I want to talk about, and then we're going to see the video that Tucker put together for us. Well, Tucker and Ashley. So last week, we talked about Jacob and Esau and the stew and Jacob tricking his brother to get the birthright. Well, there was another part, which was the blessing that was passed on directly from father to eldest son. So their father Isaac was old and blind, and if you remember from last week, Esau was incredibly hairy, and so with the help of his mother, they conceived a plan, and Jacob covered his arms with goat hair, covered his neck, so that when his blind father reached out to touch him, he would feel the hairy son. He must have been really hairy. And he wore Esau's clothes, and he brought his favorite food and presented himself as Esau so that the father, Isaac, gave Jacob the blessing. Jacob stole the blessing. Well, you can imagine that when Esau found out, he was a little upset, just a little. And his mother encouraged him to run away, to run where he could find a new family, really extended family, to find a wife. And this is where our story this week picks up, and with the creative connection.
When Jacob found out his brother Esau was planning to kill him in revenge for deceiving him out of his father's blessing, his mother suggested he flee to stay with her brother Laban. Isaac blessed Jacob before he left and told him not to marry a Canaanite woman, but find a wife from the daughters of Laban.
So Jacob set off on a long journey north to Haran, where Laban and his family lived.
On his travels, he stopped for the night because the sun had set. Taking a large stone, he put it under his head and lay down to sleep.
He had a dream in which he saw a stairway resting on the earth, with its top reaching up to heaven. The angels of God were climbing up and down it. There above it stood the Lord.
The Lord said, "I am the Lord, the God of Abraham and Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out in every direction. Everyone on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. I am with you and will watch over you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised."
When Jacob woke, he thought, "The Lord is in this place, and I was not aware of it." He was afraid and said, "How awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven."
Early the next morning, Jacob took the stone he had placed under his head and set it up as a pillar and poured oil on top of it.
He called that place Bethel, which means house of God.
Jacob made a vow saying, "If God will be with me, protect me, and provide food to eat and clothes to wear, so that I return safely to my father's household, then the Lord will be my God."
Jacob declared, "This is the stone I have set up as a pillar, will be God's house, and all that you give me, I will give you a tenth."
Jacob then set off again on his journey to Haran to stay with his mother's brother Laban.
It's interesting in this story because Jacob must have been feeling so lost and alone. And it was his own fault. And God comes to him, and God does not say, "Wow, you really did it this time." God comes and says, "I am the Lord, the one who has guided your family, and I am with you." He doesn't chastise him. He reminds him of the bigger picture. So we return to Romans 8, and I love the way the Message translation covers verses 15 through 17 and says, "This resurrection life you received from God is not a timid, grave-tending life. It's adventurously expectant, greeting God with a childlike, 'What's next, Papa?' God's Spirit touches our spirits and confirms who we really are, Father and children. And we know that we are going to get what's coming to us, an unbelievable inheritance. We go through exactly what Christ goes through. If we go through the hard times with him, then we're certainly going to go through the good times with him." Which is another thing that Paul is doing with the Romans here. Their identity means that it's assured that at some point it's all going to be resolved. And when we look back at our text, that's what God does too. In Genesis, he repeats his promises to Jacob, the promises that he'd made to his grandfather Abraham. You know, "The land on which you lie, I will give to you and your offspring. Your offspring will be like the dust of the earth." He's promising a future. Jacob didn't know how that was going to happen, and he had no evidence that it was going to happen. God didn't present a timeline or a 10-step plan, but he said, "It's happening." And in Isaiah, God does the same thing for his people who are getting ready to head into exile. He promises this is not forever. Everything will be made right eventually. And so here in Romans, Paul is acknowledging the world is broken. And everything, even creation, is waiting for something else. With eager longing, or one translation says, the whole creation is on tiptoe, leaning forward, waiting for something. So there will be a time when everything is made right. And we're at a point right now where we're reminded constantly of how broken the world is. Maybe it's not any more broken than it's ever been, but it feels like it sometimes. It's overwhelming. I had to stop watching the news. Like, it's a lot. But we have this promise. And Paul writes, hope that is seen is not hope. For who hopes for what one already sees? We're saved by this hope. But in moments of impatience, let us remember that hope always means waiting for something we haven't yet got. But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. So then how do we wait with patience? When we know the world is broken, when we feel this painful tension, the birth pains, as he describes it, of trying to live in this world. Well, our texts today do give us a place to start. We can wait in hopeful expectation and even rest because our identity is secure. In the text we've been talking about, God starts with a reminder of who the person is and God's connection to them. God affirms their identity without condition. There's no if statement. He doesn't wait till Jacob stops making mistakes. He comes to Jacob where he is. So for us, that's Paul's words. For we who are led by the Spirit of God are children of God. We are children and heirs of God. And becoming God's child is just choosing to claim the identity as his child. And so we remind ourselves in the difficult times, whether we're like Jacob and our chaos is somewhat self-inflicted, or like the Israelites, it is external forces out of our control, systemic issues or whatever it is, that we remind ourselves who God is, what God has done, and who we are in God. At the beginning of the story, it said Jacob stopped at a certain place. It was nowhere. It didn't have a name at that point. But when he woke from his dream, he took the stone that he'd been sleeping on and made it into a monument and named it Bethel, a holy place. That stone became a reminder of God's glory and promise. We need those reminders because we don't get to live in a world where we're always able to see God or to hear God's reassurances. We put reminders there to help us navigate in the darkness. Now, we have the advantage of being able to look at Jacob's story from the other end of it, right? We can look back and say, wow, he did go on to be the father of a great nation. And we know that the Israelites did make it out of the Babylonian exile. And we know that the church in Rome didn't just survive, it went on actually to be like the center of Christianity. But when you're in the middle of it, and you don't know what is gonna happen, that's a different story. We desperately need reminders. Another way we hold on is we embody the reality of who we are. Paul wrote these words to the Romans, not just so they'd pat themselves on the back that, oh, one day we're gonna go to heaven. It wasn't just that. He was reminding them of their identity so it could be lived out now, which is the same thing that God did in all the texts. Jacob, this was the beginning of a long journey with God. God would eventually change his name to Israel, and he would truly be the father of the nation. In Isaiah, God was reminding the Israelites to stay strong, to continue following his laws, to not forget who they belong to. And Paul went on to tell the Romans what living their identity looked like in their time and place, how loving each other should look, how to deal with the Roman authorities, how to deal with their power struggles within the church. So we have to ask ourselves, what does living like a child of God look like today? There are a lot of people out there telling us what it looks like. But if my identity of a child of God is secure, how does that free me to live? How do I live if I'm not caught up in what everyone else is caught up in? There's another text this week from the book of Matthew, and it's one of Jesus' toughest parables. It's a story about a farmer that plants a field of wheat, and then his enemy comes in and plants and sows weeds among the wheat. And the workers come to the farmer and say, "Let's pull the weeds." And the farmer says, "No, no, let's leave it, because that's going to damage the wheat. Eventually, the wheat will grow, and then we'll harvest it, and we'll be able to separate the wheat from the weeds." And if you read that story and focus on that part, the ending, it's kind of a bleak story. But I want to focus on what the farmer does for the wheat as it's growing. He doesn't give up on the wheat. He protects it. And he knows that the weeds are not going to make the wheat any less valuable. He knows that in the end, it's all going to be well. And he leaves the wheat to grow. And as the wheat, that's our job, to grow as best we can, to hold on. That's our promise for today. We're the wheat, surrounded by weeds. We're like Jacob on his own, like the Israelites headed into exile, or the Roman church struggling to find a common identity. We look to the future and cling to who we are.